nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so welcome everybody. Let me go ahead and introduce our speaker. We're happy to have Eric Hawk over from Illinois. Eric drove over this morning. He hasn't been in Illinois all that long. Eric got his PhD in Stanford, and if I remember correctly, you were Bob Dutton's student.
Mm-hmm.
But you were sitting in Ken Goodson's lab most of the time.
I was co-advised.
Okay, so he was sitting in a mechanical engineering lab. And then he did a postdoc at Stanford with Hongji Dai, who's mm-hmm. a chemist. So Eric is a good example of how interdisciplinary things are becoming. He's only been at Illinois for a short time, but he's off to a terrific start. That's been acknowledged by lots of awards. He recently received the Presidential Early Career Award, the PCAS Award, as well as Young Investigator Awards from ONR, NSF, AFOSR, and DARPA. So he's doing a lot of exciting things, and we're delighted to have him with us. Eric has informed me that if you have questions, we don't have to wait until the end, so feel free to interrupt during the talk, and we're looking forward to your seminar.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor Lundstrom. Well, after that nice of an introduction, I'm probably going to let you down. Hopefully, I will not. Okay, so as Professor Lundstrom mentioned, my name is Eric Popp. I've been with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for about 4.5 years right now. I also did work at Intel Corporation for about 1.5 years in between my Stanford gigs and my current job. And I do want to mention also that we do have a website at poplabecillinois.edu. So if you miss a reference or if you want to look something up, please look at our website later on. Some of you, I see, have laptops, so you can probably even do it while I'm talking. I won't be offended. Okay, so I normally have a slide like this when I go to Europe and I give a talk, because Europeans, not all of them, have heard of Urbana-Champaign. So it's kind of silly showing it here. But I thought I would leave it in, at least to show you some of the buildings that sort of physically where we're located in the Micro Nanotechnology Lab, and also in the Beckman Institute where I'm affiliated with. And little known fact, we live in Champaign, not Champagne, which is again how some packages from collaborators in Europe have come labeled. You know, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So, again, as Professor Lundstrom said, I just drove this morning across the state line and into Indiana. My third trip to Purdue in four years, and hopefully there will be more as the years go by. So I want to tell you a little bit about what motivates us, and actually this is something that I just picked up from the press a few months ago. Earlier this year, there was a story about this IBM Watson supercomputer that became the Jeopardy champion. And of course, this was a nice PR event for IBM and so on. But what fascinated me was the fact that the IBM supercomputer was actually using about 200 kilowatts of power to beat these two poor humans who are each operating at about 20 watts worth of power for computing and so on. Now, of course, we can argue and agree and disagree whether the IBM Watson computer itself was intelligent or not. Certainly, the IBM Watson computer probably couldn't, play a game of tennis or something like that. But what I want to point out is that there's a factor of about 10,000 in terms of power dissipation, at least for playing Jeopardy. And I do want to point out this factor of 10,000 because, for two reasons. One, because Moore's law, traditional Moore's law, as pretty much everybody in this room I'm sure is familiar, traditional Moore's law will probably get us another factor of 10 in terms of scaling, just pure physical scaling the way things have been going for the last 20 years, let's say, 30 years even, right? But two, because this factor of 10,000 will actually pop up at a bunch of other places in this talk. And I just want to highlight that. And some of these are serendipitous, some of these are maybe a little bit more deliberate, but we'll be coming back to that. Another sort of pretty picture, or maybe even more interesting, more whimsical picture that I came across about 5 years ago was this picture of a processor that an enterprising graduate student decided to remove the heatsink of the processor, put down an aluminum foil, put an egg inside it, and cook it sunny side up within a few minutes of playing whatever video game this student was playing. And of course, it's all documented right there. You know, and so they even do this on your processor even today. In fact, my graduate students have actually gone and done this in our, some of our outreach efforts. They've gone and done this with middle school kids who have fried eggs on their computer, you know, processors. Now, when I used to be, as I mentioned earlier, I worked at Intel for about a year and a half. When I worked at Intel and I showed this slide a few times internally, I used to point out this was an AMD processor. We very well know this, you know, you can do this with an Intel processor as well. In fact, I think my students were probably using Intel processors last semester when they went to cook eggs with the middle schoolers at a local school. Now, what, you know, the point of this drives home to me is that this, you know, certainly there's a significant amount of energy, being used by these electronics. And of course, if you own one of these iPhones or smartphones, you know, the battery usually lasts about a day in terms of normal use. And so on. And also some data that I put together not too long ago is I've actually, this is real data from the manufacturers in terms of roughly the average power dissipation of different, CPUs. And you can see about 2005, we've hit about 130 watts per square centimeter, which is significant if you think about a 100 watt light bulb, how hot that is, right? And sticking that inside one square centimeter. And since then, of course, we've gone to dual core, quad core, 8-core, and so on processors. And of course, we've also gone to, very, very low power processors, like the Atom processor, and there's the ARM CPUs and so on that are inside our mobile devices. So clearly, you know, we used to be on this exponential power increasing trend, and that has pretty much stopped. Right. This is now in some large way stopping Moore's Law or slowing down Moore's Law. And we've basically flatlined at about something like 50 to 70 watts per square centimeter in terms of what we can actually deal with in commercial CPUs. Speaking of Moore's Law, this is, you know, individual transistors really is where Moore's Law has actually been extremely successful from the point of view of energetics. Individual transistors have gotten significantly more energy efficient over the years. And roughly at about 2006, I think we're probably somewhere just below that right now, but about 2006, we're already below one femtojoule per operation per transistor, right? On the other hand, if you talk to sort of our physicist friends, right, they will tell us, or they will tell you, that the switching energy fundamentally should be on the order of KT, right? So we're still, I would like to point out, about a factor of 10,000 above the sort of fundamental limits per switch. Whether you agree or disagree, it's exactly KT or 3KT, doesn't really matter. The point is, we're still about a factor of 10,000 away from this. Of course, it's a coincidence, I think, that there was another factor of 10,000 earlier, but nevertheless, I want to point that out. There's that much more to go, energetically speaking. swinging to the complete opposite side, there's data centers, right? Data centers are the biggest power hogs from the point of view of electronics. And actually, for this, there's also data. There's real data available out there, because these things are published, and they're relatively well known, it turns out. So over the past 10 years, almost every 5 years, there's been a study, and the data center power use, this is the United States alone, has been doubling almost every 5 years. And keep in mind, between 2006 and 2011, we had a recession. So this would have probably been even stronger growth if we hadn't had a recession in between these 2 years. Right now, we're at about 10 gigawatts power use by data centers in the United States alone. And if you're like me, 10 gigawatts, maybe at first it sounds like a really big number. So I went and I looked it up. It turns out 1 gigawatt is the average power put out by a nuclear power plant, and 4.5 gigawatts is all the electricity used in a medium European country like Hungary, the entire country. And also, perhaps if you're interested in cooling issues or thermal issues, you might notice that about half the power in all the data centers in the U.S. is actually spent on cooling, not on network storage or servers. Actually, this is cooling is a huge part, obviously. So what do we do? In this context, obviously these are sort of our motivators, a lot of these things, but we don't necessarily work on data centers themselves. What we do is we work at the intersection of nanotechnology and energy research. And I'd like to sort of think of our work as two sides of the same coin. On one side, we're interested in devices and circuits. This is why we're mostly electrical engineers in my group. We want to lower the power at its source. So we're interested, how do you get that energy per bit down to fundamental levels, whatever the fundamental levels may be? Right? And then on the other side, we're interested in harvesting and managing, at least managing the heat if we can't necessarily harvest it. And this is where our work, our more fundamental work in thermal, thermoelectrics, and so on, happens. And of course, since we're academics, we're interested in fundamental understanding of things, but sort of also we're engineers, and so we're also interested in keeping an eye out on practical applications. It's sometimes nice to classify things by materials as well, right? Do you work on this material or the other material? Well, we work on a number of materials. And rather than classifying them necessarily by bond strength or by band gap, which I could also do, I'd rather classify them by dimensionality. And these materials actually range from zero-dimensional materials, which are basically nanotube junctions, which we're interested in for a variety of reasons, to carbon nanotubes, which are basically one-dimensional materials. They're 2 nanometers diameter or so. To two-dimensional materials like graphene and molybdenum disulfide and a few other two-dimensional materials that we work with. And then these 3D materials, but sometimes I call these 3 plus 2D materials because these are phase change materials. So what they do is, yes, the crystal itself, it is a 3D crystal, but it sort of has this added two dimensions of phase, meaning you can switch it reversibly between amorphous and crystalline phase. And so you can do some very interesting things with it, as you'll see it towards the end of my talk, the second half of my talk. What I do want to point out, especially for these 0D, 1D, and 2D materials, is that they already have one dimension at least, one part of these materials automatically satisfies some of the Moore's law scaling issues on some respect, right? So, for example, nanotubes are already pretty much about as narrow as you can make an interconnect, let's say. Graphene is already as thin of a thin body transistor could be in principle, right? And so on. Okay. Again, you know, I think it's important to put these things in a context. And one of the questions that I get from my students, especially when they start working with me, is, you used to work at Intel. You know, tell me about how this compares with silicon. Why is Intel so obsessed with silicon still, right? And where does all these new materials that we're working on fit in? And so what my answer to this typically is, look, silicon is here to stay, right? It's concrete in buildings. It's not going to go away, right? We're still going to build buildings out of concrete. Wafers are probably going to be silicon for a while, for a long time. Silicon is this very reliable Honda Civic that takes you from point A to point B. There's no connection between silicon and Steve Carell. It's himself. But I just sort of thought it was sort of a nice picture. You know, silicon is the world's best boss, the world's best semiconductor. It's really good at what it does. On the other hand, these nanomaterials they're a little wacky. They're a little weird, you know. They're sort of, they don't always work, right? But when they work, they do wonderful things, and you can say they take you back to the future. And actually what you see over here is you see a graduate student and a professor working on some nanomaterials. That's what's in that picture. Okay. More seriously though, I think from an economics point of view, it is very important to sort of take a step back and also look at the abundance of these things. So there are many reasons why silicon is so successful. But one of them, why it's so cheap certainly, is that it's the number two most abundant material on Earth, right? If Intel could make chips out of oxygen, they probably would. Oxygen is a little bit more common on Earth, right? Carbon's not too bad. Carbon's number 15 most common material on Earth, so maybe a technology based on carbon would not be too expensive, let's say, right? But some of these other materials that I'll talk about, like germanium, antimony, tellurium, are not very common, right? So basing a technology, let's say, on too much tellurium may not be particularly cost-effective, right? And of course, there's other things I'll be showing later in my talk, copper, hafnium, palladium, gold, they're all somewhere in there in my slides. And again, you can probably only use these sparingly within a given technology, at least with today's material harvesting methods and so on. So certainly we want to take silicon very, very seriously and perhaps work with silicon, not necessarily against it, with these nanomaterials. Okay, getting to the technical part of my talk, there's two different aspects of our work that I'll be covering. One of them has to do with looking at dissipation in transistors, and this particular case, graphene transistors. And the second case, looking at some of the fundamental limits of energy dissipation per bit in memory, in this case with a particular example of phase change materials. And so let's get right to it. Where do we get our graphene from? Again, this is a very, very common question that we get from collaborators and so on. And this is fairly typical answer by this point in 2011, is that on some projects we get our graphene from mechanical exfoliation. This is basically this famous Scotch tape method that yields a few layers of graphene that you can even distinguish optically on an oxidized silicon wafer. This is also what led to the Nobel Prize research award in 2010, for physics actually, that's what I meant to say. And on the other hand, we're also using chemical vapor deposition growth of graphene. This is something that we knew how to do for carbon nanotubes from a while back. It's fairly similar for graphene. We basically grow the graphene on the back of a a thin copper foil. We etch away the copper. There's the graphene. You can't see it, but you can actually scoop it out. And sometimes we can even scoop it out in a full wafer. It's got some wrinkles. It's got some imperfections, but you can actually get pretty big pieces out of it. And we usually actually work with much smaller pieces rather than with a full wafer. But I think my students did this just once to see if they could. Okay, so as electrical engineers, when we started working on graphene in about 2009, so about 2 years ago, we looked around, and again, as electrical engineers, one of the first questions that you ask is, how well do I understand transport? How well do I understand mobility? How well do I understand velocity saturation? And perhaps how good my models are, right, to work with transistors or memory or sensors or whatever I'm trying to do. And so one of the first questions, like I said, we asked is these, and we did some measurements of our own just to see how we compared with the literature. But we particularly wanted to focus on temperatures above room, you know, above room temperature and above rather, and going to higher fields, because a lot of the data that was available in literature up until about 2009 was actually low field, you know, low charge density, low temperature transport, right? So what we did is we measured the mobility of sort of round-the-mill exfoliated graphene on SiO2, and we can see it's actually a significant function of temperature as you go up towards 500 degrees Kelvin, and it's also somewhat a function of carrier density, for example. And then we've also measured the velocity saturation in graphene, and here's the velocity saturation in graphene. By the way, this is a comparison with silicon. It's about 10 to the power 7, and germanium is a little bit lower than that. So in general, velocity saturation in graphene is significantly higher than silicon, but it scales inversely with carrier density, and this has to do with the actual band structure in graphene, whereas in silicon and germanium, the velocity saturation is roughly independent of carrier density. So this is maybe something worth noting. It is also, velocity saturation is a function of temperature, but it is also a function of temperature slightly in silicon, just a little bit. And then, like I said, in terms of practical models, because we did want to work, you know, to actually design devices and maybe help design circuits with these materials, we also came up with some fairly simple measurement and some physics-based models to actually explain the experimental data that we're taking. And since then, for the last 2 years, these are the models that we've actually used internally in a lot of our simulations that I'll be showing a little bit later. We also have, we've also developed some simple analytical thermal models for these things. But this is actually even simpler. This is, there's really no, yes, sorry. Yes, of course.
So, in some materials like silicon, the velocity saturates. In some, like 3.5, it doesn't completely saturate. It just slows down.
Right.
What happens in graphene? Is there an actual saturation or?
So in our experiments, we were not able to achieve full saturation. So I actually don't have the plots over here, but they're actually in this paper, this APL paper, which I'd be happy to share with you. The velocity field curves were starting to saturate. And what we did is we basically assumed they would saturate, so we fit something to them and we extracted this. There are several Monte Carlo simulation papers that I've seen on, you know, calculating velocity saturation in graphene. And I've seen both curves that sort of peak and then come back down. And I've seen curves that just nicely saturate. And it all depends on the interplay of impurity scattering and which phonon scattering you put in. So I think that's still a little bit of an open question. But we've assumed for all our, well, for the data that we were able to take, and like I said, unfortunately, I don't have all the data on this slide, we've assumed that there's sort of a simple saturation, and that seemed to work with all the device measurements that we've been taking so far. But I think there is some, there's definitely some work still to be done, whether you go to really, really high fields or really, really low charge densities as well. Yeah. Okay. So in terms of the mobility itself, since we were just talking about velocity saturation, let me just go back briefly to mobility. And I do want to point out that mobility for these materials is not really just a number. Very often you'll hear people say graphene has a mobility of 100,000. But I think the context is very important, right? It's very important to say, is it 100,000 at room temperature? At what charge density? And so on. Is it on a substrate or is it suspended, right? So what I've done here, is I've taken some of the data from the literature on silicon, germanium, indium antimonide, gallium arsenide in here somewhere. I didn't label all of them because it was getting a little bit complicated. And I plotted both electromobility and hole mobility as a function of carrier density. And silicon and germanium, you can see generally electromobility is factor of 2 or so higher than hole mobility. And even in, you know, something like indium antimonide has very, very good electromobility. And this is strained indium antimonide. It has sort of about as good of a hole mobility as you can get. So the data that we were taking, that sort of round-the-mill exfoliated graphene on SiO2 data that we've been taking and other groups have been taking is these stars right here. And here's the suspended graphene data, actually at 230 degrees Kelvin, from a study from Columbia University. This is usually what when people say 100,000 mobility, they usually refer to this study right here. This is not exactly at room temperature, it's actually at fairly low carrier densities. Two things. Mobility generally decreases with carrier density. This typically happens because as you go higher in carrier density, you pick up larger density of states, you have more scattering mechanisms and so on. In silicon and germanium, there's also an increasing part of mobility, actually, which is due to impurity scattering. Graphene, we haven't really seen that, neither us nor other groups, to my knowledge. More recently, I actually have to update this plot now because I've become aware of some data for graphene on boron nitride, which is somewhere in between these two, so it's actually better than that. The other thing I do want to point out is, as far as holes are concerned, I'm not aware of a material with better hole mobility than graphene at this point. And this is the only material besides carbon nanotubes that I can think of off the top of my head that has pretty much equal electron and hole mobility, or velocity saturation for that matter, within a factor of a few percent. So I think those are sort of interesting things to think about as electrical engineers who are sort of looking at devices from these things and also trying to evaluate these materials and compare them with what's already known about other materials. Moving on, as I mentioned earlier, my group is interested in fundamentals of power dissipation. So again, one of the natural first things for us to do, or maybe the second thing that we did, let's say after the transport study, was to put this material in a device configuration, three-terminal device configuration, because we have the back gate from the silicon wafer back here. There's a source, there's a drain, or whichever one you want to call it, source and drain. These are fairly large devices. This is a monolayer device, that's a bilayer device. It's a little bit hard to see. But they're deliberately big in this case because we wanted to actually put them underneath our infrared thermal microscope. We have one of these thermal microscopes in our lab, and we know that the resolution for these things is about 2 microns, and we said, well, let's make big devices at first, because making big devices is easier than making small devices, but also because then we might actually see something with this infrared thermal scope. And to be honest with you, what we actually got a lot more out of this than we expected originally. It was one of those experiments where we just say, hey, let's see what happens. We hadn't really thought it through. We had the devices, we had the infrared thermal scope. We knew we were going to get probably a signal out of it. We just didn't think we were going to get a signal this beautiful, I guess, if I can call a infrared thermal signal beautiful. This is actually the raw data from the infrared thermal signal. This is the drain. This is the source. The gate is somewhere underneath. These, again, keep in mind, these are very big devices. So this is a 10-micron scale right there. And so what you see is this hot spot, this temperature hot spot, that's essentially moving around depending on the gate, source, and drain voltages, right? And we said, wow, this is very, very interesting. Where have we seen this before? It turns out we had actually seen this before in some studies from IBM from about 5 years ago, which had looked at light emission from ambipolar conduction in carbon nanotubes. Sort of very, very similar pictures, right? In this case, we were actually seeing what we thought was heating. Graphene doesn't have a band gap, so it's probably not direct, light emission. But certainly heating. And so then we said, okay, well, we need to develop better models to understand this, right? We need a self-heating model. We need a Poisson, solver. We need drift. We need diffusion and so on. So we got to work, and after we, motivated by this data, we got to work, and we developed a computer model, for the carrier densities, for field, for temperature, and so on. And finally, we were actually able to understand, through modeling, what was actually going on over here. And long story short, what we learned, in fact, is that the hot spot pretty much always corresponds to the minimum carrier density in the graphene channel. And this happens because graphene is ambipolar by nature. This is not doped, so you can basically electrostatically move the doping around by changing the gate voltage. And so this literally the peak temperature always corresponds to the peak electric field and the lowest carrier density, which happens to be, probably best to see it here, exactly where the electron and hole carrier densities cross each other, right? Now, in hindsight, this actually makes a lot of sense, right? Graphene is, the device is basically a one-dimensional conductor, so of course you're gonna get the most heating where the device is most resistive, meaning where the carrier density is gonna be the lowest, right? In hindsight, it makes perfect sense, but like I said, at the time, we were actually fairly surprised by this, but now I think we understand it, fairly well. And this was summarized in these two papers, one in Nanoletters and one more recently in ACS Nano, where we've played a little bit more with the model and we did more careful measurements, as well. I do want to say a word about the simulation because, the simulation is really an integral part of our research. And without the simulation, we would not have been able to understand this, at least not to the level that we did. So we put together this iterative solution of all the equations that we could throw in there for a relatively large graphene device, current continuity equation, Poisson equation, as I mentioned, and the thermal equation. And of course, this is all nicely iterated. And also, since I am speaking at the home campus of the NanoHub, I should point out this is also available as something called GFET tool as of the summer, on the NanoHub. So you can actually run the exact same simulations that we ran to explain our data on the NanoHub right now. And you can also get temperature profiles, you can get current versus voltage, of course, and you can play with contact effects and so on. And of course, if you find problems, please let us know, because we would love to have your feedback. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit. And tell you that, okay, we had looked at power dissipation in graphene. We had learned some interesting physics about dissipation, about what happens when the carrier densities change and whatnot. But remember that the resolution, the spatial resolution of the infrared thermal microscope is about 2 microns. So we realize that the infrared thermal scope is actually telling us absolutely nothing useful about the contacts, right, or about smaller devices. So then what we did is we got in touch with our collaborator, Professor Bill King in mechanical engineering, who's a scanning probe expert. And they have this wonderful tool called the Scanning Joule Expansion Microscopy, or SGEM, which basically is an AFM tip that scans over the sample. The sample is covered by a PMMA film. And of course, as the graphene device gets hot, the PMMA film expands. And what are AFMs really good at? They're very good at picking up vertical expansion, or vertical motion, I guess, or dimensions of the PMMA film, which then we can convert back to temperature of the device through a calibration process, obviously, right? So when we looked, by the way, this is a pretty slow process compared to the infrared thermal study. So when we looked at the sort of a full device, this is a fairly big 4x4 micron device. When we look at the full device, it looks about the same as what we had seen before with the infrared scope. So we said, okay, this took a long time to acquire. Let's maybe just focus on the contacts right now, because that's where the real new physics would be revealed by this high-resolution thermal study. So we looked at the contacts, and again, what we found at the contacts was not something we immediately expected. And in hindsight, it makes a lot of sense to me right now, but at the time, we were actually kind of puzzled by it. So what we saw, first of all, is we saw that here's the contact. This is the measurement. If you look up here, the measurement is up in the top left. This is the measured temperature. This is topography. So the graphene is over here on the left, and then the contact is on the right. So of course, if you move the voltage from 1 to 1.5 to 2 volts, the temperature, just due to Joule heating, will go up sort of as the square of the voltage. That's pretty expected. The first thing that was a little bit surprising to us is look how hot the contact is, still pretty deep in. This is a 1 micron sort of profile into the contact, from 2.5 to 3.5 microns. The contact is actually still relatively warm, fairly deep into the metal. This is palladium metal, I believe, in this case, but we've tried both palladium and gold. So that's the first thing that we noticed. And then the second thing that we noticed is that if we reverse the current flow direction, the temperature in the contact changes, right? This is the 4 micron channel length device from the previous image. So that's a fairly long channel, and we're just zooming in on one of the contacts. Yeah, here. 4 or even more, perhaps. Between 4 and 8, I think, something like that. Yeah. Decided is, again, we wanted to revisit our simulations because we realized that, wait a minute, the simulations that we had developed for the infrared thermal imaging study were predicting a constant temperature in the contact. They weren't even predicting that the temperature would necessarily decay like this over such a long time scale. They were simply predicting that the temperature would, pretty quickly decay into the contact, which is a fairly good thermal conductor. It's a big chunk of metal, essentially. And also, they were not at all predicting the change in temperature as you change the current flow direction, right? So the first correction that we actually had to make is we had to basically think a little bit more and read through the literature and sort of understand this current crowding phenomenon that happens when you're essentially pushing the current from a two-dimensional film into a three-dimensional contact. And to the best of our understanding right now, this is the model that we have for current flow between the graphene and the metal. You have a lot of current that gets pushed in right away, but then the current, you know, more and more, or less and less, rather, actually, of the current gets injected into the metal contact over a specific length, also known as the transfer length. And this, by the way, is consistent with other studies that have appeared around the same time as this paper actually came out. And the transfer length for these devices was on the order of 0.3 to 0.5 microns, slightly dependent on mobility, depends on gate voltage, carrier density, and so on, obviously. So first of all, we actually had to be very careful about this current crowding effect into the contacts to really understand the heating inside that we were seeing inside the contact. But the current crowding alone does not explain the asymmetry of the temperature profile with respect to the current flow direction. So for that, we actually had to go back to the drawing board and actually put in Seebeck effects, right? Keep in mind the metal, let's say something like palladium, has a very, very low Seebeck coefficient, but the graphene Seebeck coefficient as of late 2000, so basically a year ago when we were doing this work, late 2010, had already been measured. So we just took the graphene Seebeck coefficient, as had been measured by various groups around the world. We took the palladium Seebeck coefficient, which is known, it's actually almost zero. We put them into our model, and suddenly we were actually able to explain the measurements that we were taking. And within a very good approximations, these two actually look very, very similar. And again, keep in mind, we were not deliberately trying to fit the Seebeck coefficient. The only fitting parameters in these simulations were the mobility of the device, which you get from the low field measurements at least, right? And then the second fitting parameter is the contact resistance, which essentially dictates the actual current injection physics and the transfer length at the contact itself, right? And the sort of the contact resistance that we're getting is on the order of, depends which units you prefer, 200 ohm microns squared in per area units or 500 ohm microns per width units, which are fairly average for typical graphene devices with palladium contacts these days. They're not particularly good contacts, by the way, but they are what they are. Okay. So, yes.
Are these supported devices or suspended?
These are all on SiO2 devices. These are all supported by SiO2. What happened? What do you mean? What?
The transfer.
Yeah. So, well, you know, the SiO2 gets warm as well, but that's all part of the modeling and the calibration that has to take place when we do the scanning joule expansion microscopy extraction. So that's all essentially backed in there. But maybe I should go back to the picture right here. So, yeah, actually, you're absolutely right. It's not necessarily obvious that this is SiO2 because I didn't label it. But when you actually look at what the unknowns, at least the thermal unknowns, are in this device, the palladium is fairly well known, the SiO2 is fairly well known, the silicon certainly is well known, PMA is well known, the only unknown is the graphene, right? Even the thermal expansion coefficient of the PMA is actually it's very, very well known because Professor King's group had done this kind of work extensively on interconnects, right?
Is your microcontact wider than graphene?
It is a little bit wider than the graphene in this case. The graphene, let's say, well, you can't see it here. So graphene here was maybe about 4 microns wide. Yeah, the metal contact, you can actually see it. It goes sideways as well. Yeah, it's a pretty wide metal contact. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what I want to point out is that, okay, this looked interesting. It's a nice physics study, I suppose, device physics study. But only about one third of this temperature variation at the contact seems to be due to this Peltier Seebeck effect, depending on which way the current flows, right? So the question that we wanted to ask, and it's a question that we can only answer through simulations right now because our devices are not good enough for this yet today, is could you actually design a device for which, under some conditions, or are there such conditions, under which Peltier cooling at the contacts could actually offset this Joule heating at the contacts, right? And it turns out that, yes, simulation-wise, you could do that. And this would happen if you increase the mobility of the devices, if you somehow were able to increase the Seebeck coefficient. Seebeck coefficient in nanoribbons is higher than in graphene, for example, so perhaps that's one way to do it. And if you were able to lower the contact resistivity, which again is something that as device designers are improving their devices, something that we want to do anyway. So all of these things are things that we would want to do anyway, and they would also lead, we think, through our simulations, to enhanced Peltier effects at these contacts, right? So therefore, sort of an interesting idea that pops out of this is that we might be able, on some way, to engineer the heating and cooling at these device contacts. And I do want to point out that this is not necessarily new. It may be new for MOSFET-like devices, but it was actually done for lasers almost 10 years ago by a group from MIT, and Professor Shakuri, actually, who I don't know if was able to join us. But Professor Shakuri is involved with this study, and Professor Rajiv Ram from MIT, and Kevin Pipe, who's now at the University of Michigan, actually, were involved with a study about 9 years ago, in which they've actually demonstrated a similar effect in lasers, in which they arranged the band structure of the laser such that the structure was still lasing, but it was also thermionically cooling internally while operating. So maybe we can start thinking about this in the context of devices as well. Yes? That's right. So there's no free lunch. That's right. So you would need to basically, you know, it's basically a question of where do you want to dump the heat. The heat is still going to be in the circuit. Absolutely. It's not going to go away into the air. Very, very good point. That's right. But you could design contacts perhaps differently, or you could engineer the contacts in a certain way. Perhaps it could just give you an extra knob in designing something like this. And the thing that I like is that you might be able to get this for free out of general device progression that you might get anyway. Or at least something that it's there. Yeah. Okay. Just very briefly before I move on to the next completely different topic, or next different topic, is nanoribbons. Graphene nanoribbons are essentially sub-50 nanometer wide. I call them sub-50 nanometer wide graphene strips. You might have slightly different definitions. And one of the questions that we were interested in, and I think other people have been interested in as well, is how good are graphene nanoribbons for interconnects, right? Graphene nanoribbons especially would be particularly good or could be good scaled interconnects. Perhaps they have high thermal conductivity, high electroconductivity. Are they better than copper, for instance, right? But also another interesting question to me was, what are the fundamental limits of how much current you can actually push through these things before they break down? So we did exactly this in a collaboration with Professor Hongji Dai and Professor Depdeep Jena. Hongji Dai from Stanford, Depdeep Jena from Notre Dame. So we had these graphene nanoribbons, which we pushed to really high currents until they essentially broke. And then we started comparing them with our model and with what we knew about breakdown and so on in carbon nanotubes, in large area graphene and other materials. And so the first thing that, again, we learn is that high field transport seems to reveal a very strong role of self-heating, certainly heating-induced breakdown in these graphene nanoribbons, right? In fact, here's our model, and I apologize, this might be hard to see in the back, but the model without self-heating is this dashed line going, sort of keeping increasing and doesn't break down, and for the other device right here too. And of course, if you turn on the self-heating, you can actually simulate exactly the turnover of the curves. It's not really a current saturation. It's really more of a Joule heating induced stoop. And you can also simulate their breakdown. And we can even simulate the breakdown location, which is typically in the middle of the graphene nanoribbons where they're the hottest. Okay. So that's fine. We sort of already knew this from previous modeling of large graphene. Not particularly new things there. But nanoribbons are a little bit, you know, they have their own surprises. At least they had them for us. What we realized pretty quickly is that large graphene devices supported on SiO2, to address the previous question, large graphene devices will dissipate their heat directly into the SiO2, sort of as these vertical red arrows will show. Small graphene nanoribbons will actually be able to spread the heat laterally as well, right? So in a way, they have sort of an effective thermal width that is larger than the effective physical width of the graphene nanoribbon. That's what this essentially amounts to. And if you actually look at the maximum current density that you can push through these nanoribbons, we were able to push for graphene nanoribbons less than about 0.3 microns in width and length and whatnot. We were able to push current densities up to about 3 milliamps per micron before they broke down. And this current enhancement versus large area graphene scales exactly as the square root of the thermal conductance of these devices. So the thermal conductance, as you scale from a really wide device to a really narrow device, may go up by a factor of 9. The current density goes up by about a factor of 3. So it's another hint that it's actually a heating-limited process, right? Okay, that by itself was interesting, but what about heat transport along the graphene? It turns out that for some of these nanoribbon devices, if they're relatively short, you also get a significant amount of heat dissipated into the contacts themselves. Again, this makes sense, but this doesn't happen in very long devices. In very long devices, all the heat pretty much just goes into the substrate, right? But in short devices, you'll get some into the contacts as well. And this enabled us to actually ask the reverse question and say, okay, well, if heat goes into the contacts and we have a model and we have the data, what is the thermal conductivity along the graphene? And what we found, again, surprised us a little bit at the time. We found that the thermal conductivity within some fairly generous error bars is about 100 watts per meter Kelvin along these narrow ribbons of graphene. And this is actually remarkably lower than large graphene devices, which maybe in hindsight is not that surprising because small graphene ribbons have edges, right? Mobility in small graphene ribbons is also lower than in large area graphene, right? And so here, by the way, this is a log scale plot. So here's the thermal conductivity data for suspended graphene. It's something like a few thousand. Graphene on SiO2 is about 600. This is CVD graphene, I believe. I didn't label it because it was getting busy. And this is sort of what the data that we were getting from the graphene nanoribbons. And again, I want to mention, this is an experiment which is not really well designed for extracting the thermal conductivity, so we're actually improving on this right now. We've designed experiments to look specifically at the thermal conductivity a little bit more carefully, but still this gives us a first order cut at what to look for. So what about, you know, going back to interconnects, what about graphene nanoribbons and interconnects? Well, what we learned in this study is that the current density is higher than we expected, which is a good thing. Because the heat spreading actually helps you in nanoribbons, right? On the other hand, the thermal conductivity was lower than we expected. In fact, it's lower than copper, right? So I think these are actually very, very important things to be kept in mind as the community and the field moves forward, perhaps thinking about graphene as interconnects or any other kind of sort of nanoscale devices. Yes? Along the ribbon direction, that's right. In the direction of the little lateral red arrows. I apologize, this is a little bit hard to see this little picture, but the details are inside this paper and FISREV letter. But it's definitely along the ribbon, yeah. Yeah, we can talk about that offline, but the thermal analysis here is, I believe, much more comprehensive. So, but we can talk about that offline as well. I'm aware of that. I'm sorry, can you repeat that question? The thermoelectric, does it play a role here? It probably does. It was included in the simulations that we used to back this out. So everything was in there. By this point, we had learned enough from the previous studies. Everything I've actually presented was in chronological order, sort of the way we were learning things. So this is the most recent study. So it was in there, yeah. So if there was a little bit of cooling, it was there. But I think in these devices, especially near breakdown, the Joule heating was actually really overwhelming, you know, any kind of cooling effects of the contacts in these devices. Okay, so... You know, maybe before I move on to phase change materials, maybe the next brief interlude is sort of to say, where do we go from here, right? So we've learned a lot about graphene devices, device physics, dissipation, contacts, and so on. What do we do next? This is not just a question for my group. This is a question for the community as a whole. So perhaps. I think a good direction to move in certainly is to look into graphene circuits, sensors, hybrid systems. Again, let me emphasize hybrid systems. Silicon is not about to go away, right? So I think it's much better to think of graphene as, you know, graphene integrated with silicon, graphene integrated with transparent electrodes. I'm sorry, with transparent substrates. This is actually some recent work that we've done with Professor Rogers' group where we integrated graphene interconnects, speaking of interconnects, with LEDs on transparent substrates. We can also make these devices now at the wafer scale, so we can actually have serious conversations with our circuit designer colleagues, and we can say, look, these things don't really have a band gap. It's hard to make a band gap, right? You can make nanoribbons, you know, to have a band gap, but it's tough. But we can still design things that take advantage specifically of the properties at which this material is good at, and perhaps avoids the ones that it's not good at. And then I want to point out that graphene is just the tip of the iceberg as far as 2D materials are concerned. If graphene is a teenager in terms of maturity, right, is a teenager sort of about to, think about what to do with his or her life, right? This is graphene right there. These are the children in terms of devices, right? These are little kids And in terms of the community, we really haven't looked at these things, right? And there's been some work in the last few years on boron nitride, niobium selenide, molybdenum disulfide, topological insulators, and so on, bismuth telluride, and so on. But they're really, I think, in terms of the two-dimensional aspects of these materials, we've really just begun to scratch the surface, right? And for instance, you know, we started looking at molybdenum disulfide devices, just two-dimensional devices recently. Band gaps are about 1.8 eV, so that's a wonderful band gap. Certainly mobilities are not amazing. They're about 20 centimeters squared per volt second. The on-off ratio is very good. But maybe you could argue that for ultra-scale devices, what you need to avoid leakage, perhaps you need really large band gap, and the mobility may be less important. Right. So again, these are just sort of future directions that perhaps could motivate more research, both from my collaborators in the audience as well as the field as a whole. Okay. So not to waste too much time, but I do want to switch gears to memory. And I do want to talk about our work in memory just very briefly. But before I do that, I would like to ask the question, why does anybody care about participation in memory? Memory, even when I was a graduate student, let's say 7-8 years ago, memory was not something you thought about in terms of participation, as a participation hawk. Fast forward to 2010, and this is real data from Intel, 45 nanometer CMOS process. It turns out that memory is actually a pretty significant part of the power pie, if you want to call it that. So if you're running at full throttle, about 20% of the CPU power is actually being spent on memory. And if you're running in low power mode, it's actually about 70% is spent on memory. So that's a pretty significant chunk. Perhaps we should take memory seriously as far as memory power dissipation is concerned. So the next thing that I did about the time that I saw this study, I said, let me look at the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors, also known as ITRS. 2010 at the time. And so I plotted programming time, which is basically the speed of these memories, as a function of programming energy. And here's picojoules per bit, right? And what I noticed is that there's no free lunch, once again. There's never a free lunch. Maybe if you're a graduate student, there is a free lunch. But in research, there's very rarely a free lunch. And so here we are with NAND flash, which is what's inside our cell phones. Here's we are with MRAM. These are basically sort of high power but fast devices. These are low power but slow devices. And so there's always a trade-off between speed and energy. This is the lack of a free lunch that I mentioned. We want to be down here, essentially, in memory. We want to be this point or even maybe off the chart at really low power and really high speed, right? So one particular device that I'm going to, or a particular technology type that I'm going to pick on is this phase change memory. And the reason I'm interested in phase change memory, among other reasons, is that it's been shown to be fairly scalable. So if you plot all the data available in literature for phase change memory, you know, there's fairly good consensus that they're actually quite scalable in terms of the programming power. Programming and erase power, right? So the question is, how do you get from what's essentially nearly commercial phase change memory, this orange dot right there, how do you get down there? Right. That's kind of what we wanted to understand. And also we wanted to know, again, as academics, we really are interested in fundamentals. We want to know what are the fundamental smallest size and power limits, right? Phase change memory may sound like a strange concept, but I want to assure you, you actually own this stuff. You have it at home if you own rewritable DVDs. It's the active layer on the back of rewritable DVDs, where the programming is obviously done with a laser pulse rather than with a electrical pulse. But essentially what you have is you have this material, germanium, antimony, tellurium, for which switching between an amorphous and a crystalline state is induced by Joule heating. And whether you get the Joule heating by electrical current or you know, laser pulses, obviously that's different programming features. It's a fairly fast phase change. About 1 nanosecond has been demonstrated in the past. So actually, that's pretty serious for memory applications. And the change in electrical resistance is pretty high as well, which is why it makes sense for electrical memory applications. And there's actually some fairly big players like Intel, IBM, Samsung that are playing with phase change materials for memory. In fact, Samsung, it has been leaked to the press as far as I know. Just a few months ago, they started shipping very surreptitiously cell phones to Europe. And Canada, I think, not the U.S., but Europe and Canada, I think, that had phase change material memory inside. So they were just sort of testing them to see how they would work in a realistic market scenario. So it's actually getting pretty serious. However, the problem still is that despite the speed, these things are fairly large power hogs, right? So they don't really make sense to be used in a large scale applications yet. The programming currents are about 0.1 milliamps for the best commercially available applications, as far as I'm aware. So what we did is we said, okay, we work with nanomaterials, in this case carbon nanotubes, and as you know and we knew from previous work, carbon nanotubes are wonderful as extremely small electrodes.
Right.
In fact, they're the smallest electrodes that are metallic and that I could think of at the time. Maybe we can come up with something better, but I think they're still pretty good. So what we did is we took some very simple carbon nanotube devices and we cut them in the middle. So this is the device structure right there. We just cut a little nano gap in the middle. We cut it by either AFM cutting or by electrical, you know, zapping. It doesn't really matter as long as we had a gap actually for this study. And it was a nano gap, I suppose. And then we filled it with this phase change material. We actually sputtered the phase change material everywhere. But we are lucky because even though it's sputtered everywhere, it's amorphous when it comes down. So it only changes phase when you apply a voltage inside the little gap, because that's where the highest electric field is inside this little gap right there. So we were actually able to switch these mini nano bits, I suppose, of phase change material with carbon nanotube electrodes with currents on the order of 1 microamp, which is about 100 times lower than conventional phase change memory, as you might see in like I said, nearly commercial memory devices. So here's sort of one of these typical switching curves. The voltage is not quite as low as I'd like it to be. I'd prefer to be down at 1 volt. It's about 3.5 for this device. We've had some better devices since then. We have lots of worse devices, but we know how to control the voltage. In fact, the voltage scales very nicely with the gap size. So as long as you know what the nano gap size is in your device, you can actually predict what the voltage switching is going to be. So obviously, you know, we have some devices that are 30 volt switchers and or almost 30 volts, and those are not too exciting. But we do have a lot of devices that switch below 10 volts, and as long as we can keep our nano gaps to sort of sub 20 nanometer range, we can actually switch these devices at about 2 volts or so, which is roughly where our best switching devices are today. We didn't find a very clear scaling with carbon nanotube diameter. This is actually sort of an inset. Programming current is a function of carbon nanotube diameter. I would have expected something, but we didn't find any scaling with nanotube diameter. So this is actually still an open question that we're scratching our heads about. However, the programming power and the programming energy are actually quite good. They're on the order of hundreds of femtojoules for energy. At the moment, limited by our own measurement setup, which is 20 nanosecond pulses of voltage. If we can make shorter pulses, we can actually reduce that, right? We've done simulations for these as well, and you know I'll go through this more quickly right now since I think we're approaching the end of my time. But what we learn is that it's really the small volume of the GST bit that actually induces the really low programming current, right? And so in this case, the carbon nanotubes themselves, they're only magical in the sense that they're extremely small conductors, right? And they remain conductive at these extremely small scales. And otherwise, you know, carbon nanotubes are stable at high current densities. Sure, that's a given as well. But you really only need a few microamps, and certainly carbon nanotubes can easily deliver a couple of microamps, let's say, right? Just to wrap up, I want to tell you about something that we're actually still working on right now. So I'm very excited about this. I thought I would share it with you. It's something that's in preparation, but we've been able to take the devices that I just showed you before, and we've been able to actually scale them by another factor of 10 or so in energy. But to do that, what we've done actually, we've created these self-aligned nanotube nanowire bits. So essentially what we do is we use the carbon nanotube as a heater to burn off a nano trench inside a layer of PMMA. So it turns out if you cover nanotube PMMA, run a current through it, you can actually burn off, emboss, if you will, a little nano trench in the PMMA. Then we can actually deposit the phase change material in there. We lift off PMMA like usual, and we're left with a self-aligned nanowire that now sits on top of the nanotube. And I'm not showing it to you, but they're actually, afterwards, we do create a small gap in the nanotube, right? In between this stage and that stage, we do create a small gap in the nanotube, so there's a gap somewhere it's hard to see in there, right? I actually do call this the best of both, perhaps the best of both worlds, because we're combining a very confined volume of phase change material with a very, very small electrode, obviously. And these things switch, and they switch even better, so that's actually kind of good, of course. The on-off ratios are actually very, very nice. They're sort of over 1,000 on-off ratio, which is wonderful for multi-bit memory, for instance. We can get thousands of cycles out of these. We can't get millions or billions of cycles out of these things like industry can out of their mass-produced devices. So we're not there yet. But we're getting switching now closer to 2 volts, especially after a few burn-in cycles. We see switching at fractions of a microamp and sort of 2.5 volts, which is pretty exciting, I think. So if anything, even if it's not necessarily a mass-produced technology, I think it's a great little platform for studying sort of the fundamental limits. You know, how small can you get? How low can you go in terms of energy? Right? And I'm happy to report that we have not hit the fundamental limits yet. In fact, if you look at the previous plot that I showed, this was the state of the industry, or state of the art that I showed earlier. This is where our work actually fits in, sort of in this regime, a couple nanometer contact diameter, a couple of microamp programming current right there. And in terms of energy, we've already scaled it essentially down to this point, which is about a factor of 100 times lower. And we're now working our way on this orange arrow towards over there. But we're not at the origin of my axes yet. Yes, sir.
Well, as far as I understand, the key here is to make the base edge region quite small so that you can concentrate a large amount of current into a small area.
Yes.
Since we're depositing in amorphous, since the base edge material is amorphous in nature, so do you think if the smaller you get, the more variability it will introduce in the terms of energies and
time? Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good question. So the question was, to repeat it for the recording, the question was, as you make these things smaller, does the variability and the reliability get worse? This is a very, very good question, and I don't have a good answer. So that's actually something that we're trying to understand. We're working with collaborators, actually, to understand that. We have collaborators at Politecnico di Milano in Italy, and the University of Bologna, coincidentally, also in northern Italy. They're very good at actually doing atomistic simulations of these things and actually helping us understand what these materials do when you confine them and you make them so small. And what's actually kind of neat about these experiments is that we can now make bits that are small enough that the groups that are doing atomistic simulations can pretty much simulate the entire bit, which is kind of nice, right? So we're actually have this, dialogue across the Atlantic, trying to figure these things out, as we move on. So stay tuned, I think is the short answer. Fine. So, I want to end with, sort of a more broad overview of what maybe a factor of 10,000 means, because this has shown up a few times in my slide, and it wasn't something that I deliberately snuck in there. I just sort of, when I put these slides together, I realized, there are some trends in here. Some of these, like I said, are serendipitous. Some of these are maybe not. But I spoke about data centers at the beginning of the talk. So if the 10 gigawatts are all the data centers in the United States right now, if I were able to shrink that power consumption by a factor of 10,000, that would be the power used by two Ferrari F430s. That's 1 megawatt, roughly. And by the way, where do you get that power from? That's roughly the solar power you get from one medium-sized roof to power all the data centers in the U.S. Not too bad. Now, you might say, or I certainly said, well, I don't own a data centers, and I also don't own two Ferraris. So maybe this is something that I can relate to a little bit more. I do own one of these, or something like this. So typical smartphone, about 50 milliwatts on average. What if I shrank that down by about a factor of 10,000? You're down to 5 microwatts or so, which is a typical, wristwatch. I don't have a fancy one, but there are fancy watches out there which even today can be powered by body heat, right? Even with today's technology, even without improving thermoelectrics, could actually deliver enough heat to do that. So maybe, especially for the students in the audience, we could actually do something and push things in that direction. And so to really conclude, I want to contrast physical scaling, sort of the traditional Moore's law scaling, which will maybe get us about a factor of 10x, which has clearly been slowing down due to power dissipation issues. And I want to contrast that with power and energy scaling, which I think is a very, very exciting area. And I'm certainly very excited to be working in this area at the moment. There's certainly an area where novel 1D and 2D materials, I think, are going to play a very large role. I've highlighted some of these Peltier versus Joule effects that seem to have a pronounced effect in contacts. I certainly talked about looking at dissipation devices and obviously pushing it towards understanding circuits. And on some level, I'm very, very interested in actually looking at the ultimate energy per bit limits, as I illustrated through our work in phase change memory, where improvements of maybe even a factor of 10,000 may actually really be possible, right? So I really think there's a lot of room for optimization of energy dissipation and conversion from the atomic level. My last slide is really dedicated to the people who are actually doing the work and the people who are paying the bills. And so these are my graduate students and a few of my undergraduates. Our first alumnus, Dr. Ong, who was actually a physics department alumnus, who just graduated recently, and obviously our collaborators who have taught us a lot about materials, circuits, and devices. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. Okay, we've had several questions. Let's take a few more here.
He picks York first. Is this a electrical engineer we can't...
All right, let that hear me.
No, go ahead now.
You're not wearing blue shirts.
No, York, go ahead.
Okay, so you have come up with convincing arguments that you can model nicely the kind of heat dissipation that you saw in graphene for a rather large device. I'm assuming that after developing some confidence in your model, now we can push the model a little bit and see, okay, what's going to happen if I shrink the device dimensions to sub 100 nanometer graphene channel.
Right, right.
So what is the outcome? What would I find if I use the model in this context?
The contacts are starting to play, you know, obviously much more of a role when you shrink below, even below micron, actually, the contacts are significantly involved, especially with today's poor contacts that, as you know, we have on graphene. So contacts are starting to play a larger role. You know, thermal-wise, the graphene may go thermally ballistic if the channel is very, very short. But again, if you go to very high temperatures, that's not necessarily the case. You know, and also, I mean, again, to be completely honest with you, you know, the models that I showed are based on sort of a drift diffusion, sort of a continuum approach, right? So I don't know if I would really push them beyond about 0.1 microns. I mean, certainly industry has pushed drift diffusion to the, well, I think they're still using it sub 0.1 microns, right? But certainly we are starting to also look at Monte Carlo models now, for heat dissipation in graphene as well. So we have a small side project looking at that, but we're also working with collaborators to look at that. So, but I think the short answer is contacts. For now.
Related, so. You could have asked either one of them first.
I should, yeah.
So when you're extracting thermal conductivity from the self-heating,
yeah.
To what extent are you accounting for the energy cascade? So I my sense is that if you have a thermal source, a purely thermal source,
yeah.
You get right into the dominant phonon modes.
Right,
graphene,
right.
The non-thermal source, which is an energetic electron or a photon. Yep. Some pretty big issues there, yep. That you could miss.
Right.
Are you accounting?
No, we're not. I mean, the short answer, so just to repeat the question, I'm sorry I didn't get to repeat York's question, but to repeat Professor Fisher's question for the camera, the question was in the relatively admittedly simple extraction of the graphene of the nanorib and thermal conductivity, that's what you're asking about, right? Were we accounting for the cascade of energy from electrons to optical phonons to acoustic phonons and so on? No, the short answer is no. You know, so certainly the electrons, for example, could sneak out of the device carrying some of the energy out, right? So we say simply, look, the power put into the device is I times V, right? And we assume that all of that I times V goes into the lattice and then the lattice has to carry it out. So we could be missing the fact that electrons at such small dimensions actually carry out a significant portion of that I times V power, right?
Or optical phonons that haven't fully realized.
Or optical phonons.
I think that's part of it.
That's right. So optical phonons, the zone center optical phonons, you don't have significant group velocities, so maybe don't carry out too much heat.
But in short
devices, perhaps. So no, you're right. Absolutely. That's a very, very difficult, question. Maybe the one thing I can say is that we've done simple sort of Wiedemann-Franz law estimates, right? If you look at the, and I don't have that plot with me, here. No, I don't have it. But it's in the paper that I cited. We've done very simple Wiedemann-Franz law estimates, and, the thermal conductivity due to electrons alone seems to be always a factor of 10 less than the thermal conductivity we're estimating overall. So it still seems to be, no matter how much heat electrons are carrying out, if it's a parallel channel or something, it's still less than 10%. If you think that Wiedemann-Franz law can be applied, which, it has been applied in graphite. There's some papers from the 60s where they've applied Wiedemann-Franz in graphite, and they show that it actually still works okay in bulk graphite. In nanoribbons, bets are off, so this is actually, you know, take it with a little bit of a salt, I guess, right? Yeah, thank you.
Let's see. We better go with Dave here.
Well, you don't know.
Another blue shirt.
So for the energy tax, you didn't really have any layers of graphene you were looking at there, but would you expect effective thermal width to change dramatically as you start going to multiple layers of graphene?
Yeah.
Or is it kind of just a couple pretty well the graphene sheets?
So in that study, most of the nanoribbons were bilayer. There are a few nanoribbons which we thought were monolayer. It's kind of hard to establish the number of layers in a nanoribbon, too. But there were some nanoribbons that were monolayer. There were some nanoribbons, perhaps there were three layers, right? So within that study, you know, the error bars that you saw in there was actually accounting for the uncertainty in layers, 1, 2, or 3. That's why the error bars were pretty significant, right? So we were not, you know, pinpointing exactly a very precise number. I said it's 100 watts per meter Kelvin ballpark at room temperature. So for that study, you know, we already took that into account. Maybe if you go to thicker graphene interconnects, certainly, you know, the thermal connectivity may change because you have interlayer interactions, but also you have a larger cross section for heat flow. So, as it were, the thermal healing length, the lateral thermal sort of diffusion length, could get a little bit longer in those devices, right? So it'll scale with the square root of the number of layers, actually, this particular quantity. So it's a slightly more complicated, phenomenon, I think, because it depends on the thickness of the substrate, depends on the proximity of the contacts, depends on the number of layers, as you notice as well. Also depends on the edges. So there's at least 4 dimensions.
So, should we take one more question?
Yeah. Okay. So you are pointing out that like for active devices in your memory, the energy delay product kind of is what we should be looking at rather than just looking at the energy consumed and the switching time, right? I mean, that's how I understood your comment. So I'm expecting some kind of over X type curve that was showing that you were hinting, oh, there are 2 types of classes, but in reality, maybe you would expect that there are some equi energy delay product lines that you could plot in there.
Yes, yeah, right. You could say that, sure.
So in this picture, when you moved over, did you improve you clearly moved downwards and to the left into the right direction that you wanted, but can you quantify how much you improved this energy delay product metric?
Yeah, let me see if I can get back to that. Right, so the question, I think first of all it's a little bit, okay, to repeat the question, the question is, are there some equi-energy sort of curves in here, or equi-energy delay product curves. And I think, you know, the answer is yes, there are some, but again, keep in mind, these are all different, this is an alphabet soup of memory devices, right? So it's a little unfair maybe to compare MRAM to NAND, you know, in that respect.
Right, but you could say, okay, if it's on the same curve, then it belongs to the same type of family, and if I'm moving towards your corner, right,
You're shifting down, exactly. That's right. Yeah, so, yes, I think, here, as we move between, so now we can just focus on the orange squares, right? This is phase change, phase change, phase change, right? I do think these 3 essentially belong on 3 different, you know, curves, right? So I think there the comparison is a little bit more fair, really, in terms of the other. I mean, there's so many other implications for these different technologies that obviously, you know, comparing them the way I did is fairly simplistic, but I had to pick something. So I thought, again, just looking at the ITRS, and as you're familiar with the ITRS and all the different columns, right, I said, I think speed and energy are sort of the 2 things that I would find the most interesting to look at. I didn't look at manufacturability. You know, in fact, FE-RAM actually has a destructive read, which is why it has a little star. So this is not really a non-volatile memory. It's kind of a goofy type of non-volatile memory. You know, and there's all these RRAM type materials, and I think I called most of sort of typical RRAMs, I called them nano-ionic, although that's a very, very broad term as well. So I do think these 3 curves are, I'm sorry, these 3 devices, and we're not quite there yet. I do think these are actually fundamentally on different curves. But certainly, you know, just the energy per bit is not everything in terms of a system, right? We still have interconnects, we still have drivers, we still have displays. The display uses up 30% of an iPhone's battery life, depending on what you're doing, right? So there's a lot of things. I mean, memory is just a small part of a system, but it's an increasingly large part, I guess. It's an increasing small part. That's right.
Let's thank our speaker.
Thank you.